From the Voice of America in Washington, this is VOA Asia Weekend. I'm Ira Melman. On today's program, some U.S. lawmakers say Washington isn't doing enough to solve the Rohingya crisis.
We in the United States need to stand up and speak up. Many of us in Congress are going to do just that.
The U.S. Defense Secretary paves the way for President Trump's Asian tour by spelling out the U.S. stance on the Koreas.
Our goal is not war, but rather the complete, verifiable, and irreversible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
And hundreds of Cambodian Americans are facing deportation to Cambodia. Many have criminal records.
They're suddenly caught in a situation where ICE is once again re-detaining them and trying to deport them for a crime for which they had already served their sentences.
But that is not all of the story. These stories and much more this week on VOA Asia Weekend. Since August 25th, more than 600,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled the majority Buddhist Myanmar for neighboring Bangladesh, when Myanmar's security forces began targeting the Rohingya in response to Rohingya militant attacks on police stations. As President Donald Trump prepares to make his first trip to Asia, the U.S. response has been less than clear. The U.S. Congress is considering a range of options to pressure Myanmar to stop the deadly military attacks. Lawmakers are considering a standalone sanctions bill, but activists lobbying for the Rohingyas say a White House executive order could have the most immediate impact. Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat from Illinois, is the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Immigration, shares with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren his observations on what's going on in Myanmar toward the Rohingya, an opinion, and what's the official position of the United States on the issue.
I don't know the official position of this administration, but the kindest take on this is ethnic cleansing. That's the kindest take. And my colleagues, Ben Cardin of Maryland, called it a genocide. Whatever it is, we in the United States need to stand up and speak up. Many of us in Congress are going to do just that.
Why should this be important to the American people? It's so far away.
When it comes to American greatness, one of the things that we point to is when we stand up for things, values that count all around the world. These people, Muslim people, Rohingya people, are being terrorized by the Myanmar military. Their homes are being burned, they're being killed and raped and displaced in hundreds of thousands of numbers. They're put into refugee camps across the Naf River in Bangladesh and live under the worst, most deplorable, dangerous conditions. That's just unacceptable.
Well, according to the law in Burma, Myanmar, is in 1982, when they gave a number of ethnic groups citizenship, they specifically eliminated the Rohingyas. Why are they so resistant to letting the Rohingyas occupy that area?
Their argument, as I understand it, is they're not really citizens of Burma or Myanmar. They're really from Bangladesh. They are Bengali. And secondly, I don't think it escapes attention, they are Muslim. In a country where there is a Muslim population, but they are a concentration of a million or more Muslims within that country that has never been assimilated or accepted.
Well, apparently some of the people in the military in Myanmar say that these are terrorists.
And there was a terrorist incident, or at least a killing. You can characterize it as you wish. 16, we understand, Myanmar soldiers or law enforcement were killed. It was after some exchanges, some killing on both sides. But to argue that the response to that should be the displacement of 600,000 people is an outrage. It really went way beyond calling to justice those who are responsible, and it clearly is ethnic cleansing by classic definition.
And you're speaking about the August 25th attack, and since then all these people, they basically a scorched earth policy, and there's been rape, there have been villages burned down, and they're trying to push them out of the Rakhine area of Myanmar.
Yes, in northern Rakhine in particular. You know, we invited seven senators, Democrats and Republicans, invited the ambassador from Myanmar to come to my office yesterday, and he sat with us for over an hour and took our questions, and we'll get back to us in a week or two about his progress. What we're trying to do is tell him we are watching carefully. Any relationship we have with Myanmar is going to be dependent on the outcome of this situation, and we expect results quickly.
Well, you've introduced a resolution condemning it, and you had bipartisan support?
I believe we will.
You have legislation coming.
I can tell you that the original resolution, John McCain joined me, and we think others will too. Yes, it will be bipartisan. But we don't want to wait for the passage of this resolution, as symbolic as it may be. We want results. I mean, there are people who are suffering at this point and dying. And we called on this government, called on Aung San Suu Kyi, to really step up, speak up, and do something. First, bring in some third parties, the United Nations, NGOs, into Northern Rakhine, where they are currently being excluded, so they can see on the ground what's happening. Second, hold those responsible in the Myanmar military who burned these villages and were involved in these atrocities. Third, if there's going to be repatriation, bring in the UNHCR, the High Commission on Refugees, to bring these people back in an orderly way, demanding papers from people who have been completely displaced from their homes and their homes burned in front of them is unrealistic.
How do you get the U.S. Senate interested in this, the whole Senate? There's a lot of talk about tax reform, and we've got health care, we've got a lot of fighting going on. How do you convince the U.S. Senate that this is something that, you know, that they should focus on?
I think, you know, Senator Young, Republican of Indiana, Senator McCain, and others are willing to stand up with us and make it a bipartisan effort. We're going to have an opportunity. There'll be a bill passed before the end of the year about the next year's budget. Some of it involves our relationship with Myanmar and the money that is given to them. If we can see real progress, if we're moving to solve this problem, it's going to be a much more positive outcome for Myanmar.
Do you think the world watches us on issues like this?
I think they do. You know, America has been, we're not perfect by any means, but we have really been a leader when it comes to speaking out in these circumstances. And I will never forget, Greta, my predecessor, Paul Simon, begging the Clinton administration, do something about Rwanda, do something. They didn't. 800,000 people died.
So we're essentially, like during Rwanda's, we're watching ethnic cleansing or genocide. We're watching it happen.
We are, sadly. And when I see the pictures, I was with the Rohingya population in Chicago. We have over 1,000 in Chicago. They have their own center. I visited with them last week. They showed me the photos from these refugee camps. They're horrible. The line for food was a mile long. The line for food. Think about that, with tens and 100,000 people gathered with virtually no public health care, no drinkable water, cholera starting to show its face. All of these things demand that we move quickly.
Senator Dick Durbin speaking with VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren. Meanwhile, Myanmar police said Saturday that they had detained two foreign journalists who were employed by Turkish state media for flying a drone over parliament grounds in the capital of Naypyidaw. Several other journalists have been arrested in Myanmar this year, triggering warnings from rights organizations. As we continue on VOA Asia Weekend, the latest on the fate of Australia's Great Barrier Reef is headlined by good news, but there is a less optimistic storyline as well. With a visit by U.S. President Trump underway, the Philippine president has changed his tone of late when it comes to the United States. The Philippine leader, Duterte, is known for his often profanity-laden tirades against the United States. In the recent past, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has chided Washington for treating the Philippines, as he put it, like a dog. A year ago, during a visit to Beijing, Duterte announced his separation from the United States, declaring he had realigned with China as the two agreed to resolve their South China Sea dispute through talks. But despite human rights groups' condemnation of Duterte's drug crackdown, in which thousands of people have been killed, U.S. President Donald Trump praised the Philippine leader for doing what Trump called an unbelievable job on the drug problem. Rodrigo Duterte said Sunday he would deal with the U.S. President Donald Trump righteously.
I would deal with President Trump in the most righteous way. Welcome him as an important leader, as a matter of fact, the important leader on this side of the planet. And I would have to also listen to him, what he has to say. My responses would be calibrating what he would ask me.
President Trump's Asian journey begins November 3rd. The Philippine visit to Manila is on the last leg of his trip, with visits to Japan, South Korea, China, and Vietnam to attend the ASEAN Leaders Summit on the schedule first. In a media briefing Sunday before leaving for Japan to meet Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, Duterte further listed his menu of what he wanted to discuss.
It would be terrorism, cooperation between the two countries, the fight against drugs, and all of this, I said, expect to be dealing with him around these topics. And of course, I forgot the main, the opening agenda would really be Korea. We are worried, all of us, that, Murphy's Law, if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong.
Duterte previously described Kim as a fool and profanely criticized him for playing with dangerous toys. Trump will meet with Duterte in Manila, but will skip a larger meeting in the Philippines with heads of states and governments from China, South Korea, Japan, India, Australia, and New Zealand. The health of one of Australia's greatest natural treasures, the Great Barrier Reef, is improving, according to a new government study. But as Phil Mercer reports from Sydney, environmentalists say the report has failed to address the contentious political issue of land clearing.
The joint report by the Queensland State Government and its federal counterparts shows that pollution flowing into the Great Barrier Reef has declined. Farmers are praised for reducing the amount of harmful fertilisers, pesticides and other contaminants running from their properties into coastal waters. But poor water quality exacerbated by runoff from farms continues to be one of the most significant threats to the long-term health of the reef, which stretches about 2,300 kilometres down the northeast coast of Australia. The Joint Government Assessment of the Reef concedes that better land management practices are needed. The World Heritage Body UNESCO has threatened to put the Great Barrier Reef on its in danger list because of environmental concerns. Stephen Miles, the Queensland State Environment Minister, says work to protect the world's largest coral system is continuing.
We did accelerate our investment and our activity in subsequent years. I'm confident that the World Heritage Committee will continue to recognise the progress that the Queensland and Australian governments have made in more recent years. That's what their most recent report said.
But conservationists insist the report ignores the impact of massive tree clearing in Queensland, which they believe threatens to unleash more pollution into the Great Barrier Reef. The state government has also struggled to bring in contentious new laws to stop farmers chopping down trees. Sean Hubin from WWF Australia, a conservation group, says the problem of land clearing can't be ignored.
There's a huge amount of sediment coming in from cleared land, and until this data is properly incorporated, the government can't be claiming pollution reductions when major factors like tree clearing aren't actually included.
More than 2 million tourists visit the Great Barrier Reef each year, including growing numbers from China, South Korea and Japan. The reef is the size of Italy and has been subjected to mounting environmental threats, including rising sea temperatures, overfishing and the industrialisation of the Queensland coast by mining companies and other heavy industries. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
At least 1 in 10 people globally lives near the coast in a low-lying area. As the population increases and the sea level rises, their homes are increasingly being threatened. The countries with the most people at risk include the United States, China, India, and Bangladesh, and Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam and Indonesia. Scientists say climate change is to blame for the threat, and it has far-reaching implications. More from VOA's Elizabeth Lee.
From floods to drought, recent years have seen more of these extreme weather events.
There is no doubt that part of this is climate change. Winters are warmer. Snowpacks come later, they leave earlier. Droughts have tended to be more intense, especially here in California.
Scientists say while climate change cannot be blamed for every extreme weather event, it is definitely a factor.
It changes the odds. So the odds of heat waves are greater, the odds of stronger hurricanes are greater, the odds of more intense droughts and floods are greater.
That means communities in low-lying areas close to the coast worldwide are at a greater risk of the devastating effects of extreme weather.
We're living in a warmer world. we're living in a melting world. And of course, the unequivocal evidence is that sea levels are rising. We're living risky. We're living too close to the coast.
Scientists say although the Earth's climate does naturally fluctuate over hundreds of thousands of years,
we've never seen this much change over 100 years. And so the thing that worries me the most is not the next 1,000 years or the next ice age, but the next 100 years.
It's not natural. If it weren't for human activities, the world, under natural causes like changes in the sun, volcanoes, would have actually cooled slightly in recent decades. Warming is due to human activities, primarily to carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases and particles that mankind has put into the atmosphere.
Rising sea levels and more extreme weather have impacts that go beyond floods.
We have greater disease, spread of disease. We have deteriorating air quality because of higher temperatures.
One of the biggest impacts of sea level rise on
global agriculture must also adapt to a changing world. As seen in this film produced by the Aquarium of the Pacific, sea level rise in Bangladesh is causing more salinity in the soil. Farmers can no longer plant their regular crops and have switched to grains more resilient to salinity. Some countries are working to mitigate the effects of climate change. In Indonesia, American and Indonesian scientists and students are working to restore seagrass beds. Seagrass protects the shore from storm surges and helps take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
We can't make it go away instantly. It takes a long time, but we can act to reduce the severity of climate change.
Scientists say the solution is reducing the amount of fossil fuels and increasing the use of renewable energies. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Automakers from around the world were showing off their new vehicles last weekend at the 45th annual Tokyo Motor Show. Designers were showcasing electronic cars with advanced artificial intelligence and at least one concept car with safety features for the world around it. Arash Arabasadi had his futuristic view of the show just before its opening.
This isn't the star of a new Transformers movie. Japanese manufacturer Toyota Gosai unveiled the Flesby 2 concept car ahead of this year's Tokyo Motor Show. It changes shape if you're parking, getting in, or driving fast. And it's got safety features even for those who are not riding in the car. We put airbags, which are mainly employed inside the car, on its exterior, such as its hood or fender, to protect the entire body, as we wanted to express our concept of safety. The rubberized exterior cushions and bounces back from little fender benders while LED lights help drivers interact with their surroundings.
We wanted to create it to enable communication, not only between the car and the driver, but also between the car and pedestrians.
Science fiction the company hopes to produce by 2030. More than 36 car makers from around the world will showcase new designs this weekend. Japan's top automaker, Toyota, displays its futuristic Concept I. The car monitors the driver's face, body language, and voice to keep both human and machine on the road.
When the driver needs support from the vehicle, it automatically switches to automatic driving mode. As such, the vehicle and the human help each other and make the driving safe all the time.
Honda unveils its urban EV concept electric car, while Mazda reveals its new Skyactiv X engine, which is almost 30% more fuel efficient than the majority of today's stingiest combustion engines. Most of these cars are concepts, blueprints for the future, but when the venue's doors open Saturday to the public, the future will be here, as designers look to bring their visions to life on the assembly line. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
A high-tech version of the lie detector test has been developed by Silver Logic Labs in Seattle, Washington. Called a passive polygraph, VOA's Faith Lapidus explained how it works.
The wires and belts of a lie detector machine could be replaced by a video camera and an algorithm.
You ever lied to your parents?
Yes.
What about?
About where I was at a certain time in the morning.
So what we're doing is we're using
the video footage, we're breaking it down into data and then using quant methods or quantitative math and deep learning from the videos to determine how a person's emotional responses are tied to some stimulus. So in this instance, it was questions.
This is not new technology. It was originally developed to gauge audience reactions to TV shows and movies. Using earlier studies identifying micro-expressions that betray emotions someone may want to conceal, the Silver Logic Lab's algorithm analyzes facial expressions based on seven basic reactions, including anger, disgust, happiness, and fear.
We wanted to pan in really tight into her face so that we could get a lot of detail in that footage because we are going to be processing it and decomposing the emotional vectors to see the veracity of whether or not she believes in what she's saying.
Have you ever hurt somebody intentionally?
Yes.
Here, the algorithm detects sadness, suggesting, according to the tester, that the subject is not telling the truth, as the baseline testing indicates she feels emotional discomfort when deceitful. The idea that a video camera can identify anxiety levels and emotional reactions in real time raises privacy concerns for some, but the company says those fears are unfounded.
Well, I think this is actually a super enhancement to civil rights, because cameras and computers aren't biased to race, ethnicity, age, gender, any of that.
The passive polygraph could play an active role in the search for truth in the future. I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Has the U.S. pivot to Asia lost its balance? That story is on the way. This is VOA Asia Weekend. Many members of the Cambodian American community may soon find themselves forced to leave their homes in the United States. Others are being rounded up in the U.S., but caught in between disagreements between the governments of the U.S. and Cambodia. I spoke with Katrina Dizon Maria Tegui, the immigration policy manager at the Washington-based Southeast Asia Resource Action Center.
Earlier this year, there were roundups in the Cambodian community, but due to efforts of many advocates on both the Cambodia side and the U.S. side, Cambodia for a while had stopped issuing travel documents for Cambodian individuals. And the reason for this is because advocates in Cambodia have been pushing the government to work with the United States to renegotiate the current MOU between both countries that allows for the repatriation of Cambodian nationals. And basically, the objective of this would be to try to protect those that came into the country as refugees from being deported, because advocates were seeing that there were huge humanitarian concerns in deporting refugees. And as a result of this, unfortunately, the Trump administration responded by immediately issuing visa sanctions against Cambodia. So in September of this year, the U.S. issued sanctions on high-ranking officials of people from the Department of the Interior. And in response to this, Cambodia immediately agreed to once again start issuing travel documents. The last that we heard, the Cambodian government wanted to issue 26 travel documents, but now there's a lot of fear and concern in the community that if this is the case, why then is the United States detaining over 100 Cambodian people? And this issue has been incredibly terrifying, especially given who we have in place currently as president. And then also there's just a lot of questions and uncertainty in terms of how the U.S. and Cambodia's negotiations would look like and what would the ultimate result be and what this could mean for many Cambodian Americans throughout the country who are living in the country with deportation orders.
President Trump made it clear that anybody who is either a dreamer or a refugee, if illegal in any way, shape or form, who has a criminal record or anything on their criminal record probably would be sent back. Are any and or all of these people burdened with any kind of criminal record?
So a majority of these folks, at least the folks that we have been in touch with, all do have criminal records. They came into the country as a refugee and lived most of their lives as lawful permanent residents, but due to a number of different factors, unfortunately, were unable to naturalize.
Has there been any kind of determination as to who goes and who stays as it applies to the severity of the charges against them?
That's a really good question, and it's a question that we have repeatedly asked DHS and ICE in terms of, ultimately who ends up getting issued a travel document and trying to figure out what criteria they even look at, because all of these cases are so different. But unfortunately, at this point, we have no idea. We were told that there is an internal negotiation process that happens between both government, and they were unable to share with us the specifics of those negotiations. So at this point, we've seen a broad range of people being deported, some with more serious crimes, and then others with smaller crimes as well. It just seems like there's really no pattern in terms of the individuals that Cambodia ultimately issues travel documents to. There are thousands of Cambodians throughout the country that have been issued deportation orders due to old criminal convictions. But since Cambodia doesn't accept a huge number of Cambodians back, what ends up happening is they would be detained by ICE, issued a deportation order. But since ICE can't deport them right away, they have to release them. So they go on to rebuild their lives. A lot of them start families. They start small businesses. And mind you, these are people that have already served their sentences, so they have rehabilitated, and they have completely transformed their lives. And now all of a sudden, years later, and sometimes decades later, they're suddenly caught in a situation where ICE is once again re-detaining them and trying to deport them for a crime for which they had already served their sentences.
Is this limited to the Cambodian community?
What's happening right now is not only happening in the Cambodian community, but recently over the weekend, we have heard as well that a number of Vietnamese individuals have been detained and are being processed for interview by their consulate during the next 2 weeks as well.
I then contacted ICE, the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. Their spokesman, Brendan Reedy, issued a statement saying the United States continues to work with the government of Cambodia to establish a reliable process for the issuance of travel documents and their acceptance of the prompt lawful return of Cambodian nationals who are subject to removal from the United States. Another ICE official told VOA Asia that there are over 1,900 Cambodian nationals residing in the United States who are subject to a final order of removal, of whom 1,412 have criminal convictions. Australian Indigenous leaders say a government decision not to establish an official voice in Parliament representing Aboriginal peoples is a kick in the guts. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Delegates at a landmark First Nations summit in May called on the Australian government to set up an Indigenous body to guide and shape policy towards the country's most disadvantaged people. Indigenous leaders wanted a constitutionally enshrined voice in Parliament to help establish a path to a treaty between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Australians. However, that idea has been rejected by the government. Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull argued that an Indigenous-only representative body would be seen as a third chamber of federal parliament, in addition to the existing House of Representatives and Senate. Turnbull said most Australians were unlikely to support such a body in a national referendum because it clashed with the notion of equal rights for all. But Indigenous leaders feel let down and say the government's decision was a kick in the guts. Greens Party leader Senator Richard Di Natale says Australia's original inhabitants deserve a voice within the nation's parliament.
They want to be front and centre in decision making, and that's not a big ask. Don't do things for us, do them with us. We need to make sure that there is a strong Aboriginal voice represented in the Australian parliament at the heart of decision making.
Aboriginal Australians make up about 3% of the national population. They suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, unemployment, and imprisonment. It's been almost a decade since federal and state governments in Australia began a concerted effort to improve health, education, and employment in Indigenous communities, but there's been limited progress in key areas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. For much of President Barack Obama's presidency, U.S. officials touted the so-called Asia pivot, an economic, political, and military realignment toward a region seen as key to America's future. 9 months into the Trump administration, U.S. officials are taking a different approach to Asia. And as VOA's Bill Gallo reported, some are concerned the White House is signaling a lack of commitment to the region.
There will be no shortage of one-on-one meetings between Donald Trump and Asian leaders during his first trip to the region as president. But Trump's decision to skip a key regional summit in the Philippines may be remembered as one of the more notable parts of the trip. His absence risks upsetting U.S. allies, says Abraham Denmark, a former top East Asia official at the Pentagon.
The fact that the president will be leaving the day before the East Asia summit, I think will signal the region will see as an indication of a lack of commitment, potentially a lack of interest in Southeast Asia.
Trump's long-term commitment to Asia had already been questioned after he pulled the U.S. out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement.
You can make positive and negative arguments about TPP. It was not a net jobs creator for the United States. But what it did do is it had great strategic value. It was a marker. America was going to be here no matter what. And that's lost. And the Trump administration has not found a formula to replace that.
Instead, Trump's Asia strategy has been dominated by North Korea, leaving him little room to lay out a broader plan for the region. That could change this trip. And it won't come a moment too soon, according to Denmark.
So what our partners in Asia are looking for is not whether or not the Obama policy will continue. They're looking for what is the Trump policy? What is America's policy now? And there have been some indications in various ways. But this trip gives President Trump a real opportunity to clearly explain his approach to the region.
It's a chance for America's Asian allies to find out just what America First means for them. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
A cardiac arrest happens when the heart stops beating regularly due to mixed up electrical signals. According to the American Heart Association, when cardiac arrest occurs, every minute that passes before help arrives lowers a person's chance of surviving by 7 to 10%. However, as we hear from VOA's Kevin Enox, in a crisis when every minute counts, drones may be able to quickly get help to people who live in rural areas.
The humble drone is being considered to deliver all kinds of things, from food and medicine to your latest Amazon.com order. Soon, they may also be saving lives. The notion came to a Norwegian paramedic who was frustrated by how long it took ambulances to get to patients in rural areas.
They don't really have the opportunities of reaching distant areas, such as islands or like the archipelago of Stockholm. And the delay is about 20, 25, 30 minutes in some cases.
But drones carrying defibrillators, devices that can reset the heart's rhythm, could be there much quicker. And those minutes could be the difference between life and death for people who suffer cardiac arrest, an often deadly condition in which the heart stops beating normally.
By placing a drone on the rooftop of a fire station, we could dispatch a drone to reach 10, 15, 20 kilometers of radius in just 5 or 6 minutes. This increases the chance of survival from about 0% to perhaps 20, 30, 40%.
It is little more than an idea right now, but initial tests have shown that drones can get to people an average of 4 times faster than ambulances. Even if it works, though, there are some significant bureaucratic and logistical challenges to the idea.
We need to be able to communicate with air traffic control using transponders. We need a network where we can use video surveillance during flight and most important during landing. Perhaps a bit more battery power as well to reach further away.
The team is planning to start a clinical study sometime next year to see if the drone deliveries can actually save lives. Kevin Enox, VOA News.
October 31st was Halloween, a spooky but usually fun time when many dress up in costume, children roam neighborhoods for candy and other treats, and the prevailing theme is of monsters, spooks, and spirits. The White House in Washington has been the working and living quarters of many presidents and their families since 1800. While she has not gone up to the front door to yell trick-or-treat, VOA's Nicoleta Ilitch reports. Historian Edward Lengel of the White House Historical Association says ghosts are said to reside inside the revered landmark.
For many, Halloween is a day to dress up in costumes or take children trick-and-treating. It also gives rise to thoughts about ghosts and spirits. According to historian Edward Lengel, they haunt one of the best-known buildings in the world, the White House.
The first known sighting of a ghost took place right after Abraham Lincoln was assassinated in the late 1860s during the administration of Ulysses Grant.
Lengel says there were sightings of President Lincoln and his son Willie, who had died in the White House.
There were some stories that later emerged that Abraham Lincoln's wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, had actually seen ghosts in the White House during the Civil War. And she claimed that she heard the ghost of former President Andrew Jackson laughing in his former bedroom.
Most ghost stories date between the Civil War and the 1930s, points out Lengel.
1897. During the presidency of William McKinley, a White House policeman was walking into the conservatory, which was a former White House greenhouse, where they grew flowers and plants and all the rest, and he had seen a light glowing in the conservatory. And so he walked in, and he turned a corner, and when to his surprise, he saw an image of a beautiful woman.
When the policeman went to talk to her, she disappeared, and the light disappeared with her, says Lengel. There are some ghosts that reappeared over and over again.
Especially Abraham Lincoln. Many people have seen the ghost or claim to have seen the ghost of Abraham Lincoln, including Winston Churchill.
After World War II, there were no reports of sightings. The curator believes that one of the reasons could be
1948 to 1952, the whole inside of the White House was demolished by Harry Truman when he was renovating the White House.
Lengel says that ghosts in the White House were almost always benevolent, that there are no stories about ghosts throwing things and harming people. Also, maybe in modern times, presidents and their families do not believe in ghosts and goblins and just celebrate Halloween for fun with their guests. Nicoleta Ilitch, VOA News, Washington.
The change in relations between China and South Korea, that could be in the offing. That story is next on VOA Asia Weekend. Stay with us. After a year of tensions over South Korea's deployment of a U.S. anti-missile defense system, both the South Korean and Chinese governments Tuesday announced their leaders, Moon Jae-in and Xi Jinping, will hold a summit on the sidelines of this month's Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation meeting in Vietnam. South Korea's foreign ministry spokesman said Tuesday the meeting is viewed as getting the bilateral relationship back on track. He said both countries recognize each other's positions regarding the THAAD issue. THAAD means Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, a system that caused heated debate in South Korea but is now fully deployed to counter the North Korean nuclear and missile threat. James Kim, a research fellow at the Seoul-based Asian Institute for Policy Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty that Chinese opposition to deployment adversely impacted economic ties.
It has certainly impacted bilateral ties in the sense that we haven't seen many Chinese tourists in South Korea for the past few months. We've also heard that it's had some impact on certain companies like Lotte, which is largely responsible for the land swap deal that allowed the deployment of the anti-missile defense system here. But overall, the Korean economy has been doing very well. The Bank of Korea recently announced a new growth projection for 2017, which is higher than their previous projection, and it's at 3%. The stock market is doing quite well at an all-time high. Everything looks very good. It's just that on the geopolitical side, the tension doesn't make for a very good, friendly environment. It's still very tense here. Certainly how bilateral relations between China and South Korea goes and does contribute to other things that are occurring in the region, including North Korea.
What is China's concern about THAAD?
China's official position is that THAAD has the ability to impact its strategic position in the region by allowing the U.S. the capability and its allies the capability to surveil Chinese defensive posturing deep within the mainland. But overall, I think you could pretty much say that it does impact marginally, albeit, China's deterrence capability. And so I think there's some concern there on part of Beijing about its strategic balance vis-a-vis the United States if the U.S. has the capability to mitigate its deterrence against potential U.S. strategic threats.
James, what do you think Mr. Moon's message will be to President Xi?
South Korea has maintained its current course on missile defense. I don't think that position will change between now and the scheduled summit, but the Moon administration has also made it clear that there's no intention here to mitigate the Chinese deterrence capability. And it poses no threat to China, that South Korea's main concern is with North Korea, and that it has no other intention other than that. So it would like to compartmentalize the missile defense issue and to take it off the table as far as its relations with China is concerned, but it would also at the same time like China to cooperate with South Korea and the United States in addressing the North Korean nuclear problem.
James Kim said South Korea will take a wait-and-see attitude on how China follows through with promises to enforce U.N. sanctions on Pyongyang, even as Chinese President Xi emerged with a new mandate from the Communist Party Congress. He said China's interests remain more closely aligned with Pyongyang than with the rest of the international community. The White House said Tuesday that President Donald Trump has developed a warm rapport with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, even though the Manila leader has verbally attacked the United States in profane terms. A senior Trump administration official is talking about details of Trump's five-nation Asia visit that includes a stop in Manila, said Trump and Duterte have become friendly during telephone conversations and exchanges of letters. Their meeting is scheduled on the last stop of the U.S. president's 12-day trip that includes visits to Japan, South Korea, China, and Vietnam. Elsewhere on his trip, Trump is planning to advance efforts to force North Korea to end its pursuit of nuclear weapons. But the White House official said Trump, unlike some other U.S. presidents, is not going to visit the DMZ, the heavily armed buffer zone between North and South Korea. Also Tuesday, China's foreign ministry expressed hope that President Trump's state visit this month will help strengthen bilateral ties. Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said China expects the visit will promote more mutually beneficial cooperation between the two countries, bring more tangible interest to the two peoples, and make greater contributions to world and regional peace, stability, and prosperity. The tone was less hopeful earlier when China's U.S. ambassador, Sui Tiankai, called for a negotiated settlement over North Korea's nuclear and missile programs before the situation becomes more dangerous, and urged the U.S. to avoid interfering in regional efforts to resolve tensions in the South China Sea. The ambassador, while calling the state visit an historic opportunity, said he didn't think it would really serve the interest of these countries if their aim to sort of contain China. He said, "I don't think anybody would be able to contain China." Ankit Panda, the associate editor of the Asia-Pacific publication The Diplomat, told VOA's Victor Beatty Beijing may be referring to the pace of U.S. freedom of navigation missions.
The context here has been the stepped-up pace of U.S. freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. We've seen four from the Trump administration in 5 months. That's a marked increase in pace from what the Obama administration had been doing between October 2015 and October 2016. But to be more specific, I think the ambassador's comments refer to attempts within the Association of Southeast Asian Nations to arrive at a binding code of conduct with China. The Chinese and the ASEAN states came to a draft framework agreement earlier this year which the Chinese really welcomed. They see that as the way forward. Obviously, I think it fell short of what a lot of U.S. observers have long been recommending, in that it wasn't specifically binding in the ways that would really count at the end of the day. So I think before Trump goes to Asia, I think the Chinese ambassador saw it fit to send this message about the South China Sea.
Panda also said the U.S. role in Asian waters is debated depending on the point of view.
Washington has long said that it has great national interests in the region, including freedom of navigation and overflight and international law. But more specifically, I mean, these questions revolve around the broader question of whether the United States is an Asian power, is an Asia-Pacific power in the 21st century. And the Chinese certainly don't see the kind of role for Washington that the United States sees for itself. I do find it curious, though, that the ambassador would make these comments. The Trump administration at the highest levels of at least the political leadership has actually been quite muted when it comes to the South China Sea. We haven't heard President Trump, for example, talk about the South China Sea in a very long time. The last significant statement I can think of was by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, but also certainly Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis at the Shangri-La dialogue back in May, where he delivered a fairly clear statement of U.S. policy, which was pretty much the same as the Obama administration's policy. Also, I think, you know, going forward, looking forward to this trip, Trump is supposed to make a major address in Da Nang, Vietnam, where he's supposed to talk about this idea of a free and open Asia-Pacific. And for the first time, we'll get a better articulated Asia strategy speech from this administration. So they may be attempting to preempt that with these statements on the South China Sea.
Anki Panda said this second face-to-face encounter by the U.S. and Chinese leaders following their first summit in April in Florida likely will produce no breakthroughs on economic issues. On North Korea, he expects the U.S. to call for greater Chinese enforcement of existing U.N. sanctions, while Beijing will urge the U.S. to turn down the temperature on its rhetoric aimed at Pyongyang. The U.N. Refugee Agency reports at least 4 Rohingya refugees fleeing violence in Myanmar died Tuesday morning when their boat capsized in the Bay of Bengal, close to the southern shore of neighboring Bangladesh. Lisa Schlein reported for VOA from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
UNHCR spokesman Babar Baloch says 42 members of 6 families, including men, women, and children, were aboard the doomed vessel when it ran into rough seas while approaching the shore. UN refugee aid workers and partners on the ground reportedly rushed to the scene to provide medical aid, food, blankets, and clothes to survivors.
The boat was hit by large waves and eventually capsized, trapping people underneath. Several were injured when they hit the engine. A 15-year-old boy died on the spot, and all 22 injured were rushed to hospitals and NGO clinics, but 3 reportedly died en route.
Baloch says the remaining 19 were taken to UNHCR's transit center near Kuttapalong camp. In a separate incident, authorities in Bangladesh say 3 infants drowned after slipping from their mother's laps when a boat bringing them from Myanmar reached shore. The International Organization for Migration reports more than 607,000 Rohingya have arrived in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, since the mass exodus of refugees from Myanmar began August 25th. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says new arrivals appear to be slowing, although people continue to arrive daily in the area's makeshift settlements.
The settlements are dangerously congested and overcrowded, and the pressure on sources of clean drinking water and basic sanitation are enormous. Having walked for days without water and food, the refugees arrive to the settlements exhausted and thirsty. Many are ill.
Millman says all the spontaneous and makeshift sites where the refugees are camped out urgently need water, sanitation, and hygiene to prevent diseases from breaking out. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia Weekend. Australia has shut down its controversial offshore detention center in Papua New Guinea, but more than 600 refugees and asylum seekers are refusing to leave. The men say they fear for their safety in the local community and are uncertain about their future. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports Australian officials have left the facility and water and power supplies are being switched off.
About 600 men remain inside the Papua New Guinea detention centre. Most of them are refugees, including many from Myanmar, Iran, and Afghanistan. They insist they're too scared to leave the processing center and are refusing to move to new accommodation elsewhere on the island. They say they've stockpiled food and water, and it's unclear when or if they'll be forced out by Papua New Guinea authorities. Senator Nick McKim, an immigration spokesperson for the Australian Greens, says the detainees fear for their safety.
They don't believe it's safe here in the Manus community for them, and we've seen, you know, multiple machete attacks and knife attacks over recent months, and the guys are in the fear for their lives.
Advocates say about 480 of the 600 men inside the Manus Island facility are refugees. The rest are asylum seekers, many of whom have had their refugee claims rejected. The fate of all of them is unclear. Papua New Guinea says the men are Australia's responsibility. But Canberra won't resettle any of the Manus Island detainees under tough asylum and border protection policies. Kate Schutze, a researcher with the rights group Amnesty International, claims the Manus Island detainees are being abandoned by Australia.
Essentially, there's no real plan here for them to be able to rebuild their lives. So that's really quite alarming. All indications around these new centres and the security around these new centres seems to indicate that they're moving them from one prison to another with no logical rationale behind it.
Since 2013, Australia has incarcerated all asylum seekers who try to reach its shores by boat on Manus Island and Nauru, a tiny Pacific republic. Canberra has said the policy deters people trafficking and prevents deaths at sea. But the conditions inside the camps have been described by the United Nations and human rights groups as cruel. The United States has agreed to resettle some of the refugees from Manus Island and Nauru under a deal Australia reached with the Obama administration last year. In September, 22 men, including those from Sudan, Bangladesh and Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar, became the first to be moved from the offshore detention centre in Papua New Guinea to the United States. It's unclear how many refugees Washington will eventually resettle. In return, Australia will take in Central American refugees from the United States. Last year, a court in Papua New Guinea ruled the Australian-funded camp on Manus Island was unconstitutional. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Doctors in the United States are increasingly employing a new approach when treating tumors, thanks to the new technology of genomic sequencing. It allows them to look at each patient and his or her cancer as an individual and develop a customized therapy. VOA's George Putich reports the new approach is showing some promising results.
Instead of the traditional invasive and painful method for retrieving tissue suspected of being malignant, the new method, called liquid biopsy, can reliably find tumor cells in the patient's blood. But just looking at those cells does not tell the whole story.
So the new way to get a diagnosis is to look deep in the cell and understand precisely what made it into a tumor. And that's genomic sequencing.
In practical terms, genomic sequencing involves making a detailed analysis of the patient's genome, looking for mutations that cause the uncontrolled growth of cells into tumors. Once the results are available, doctors comprising a so-called tumor board gather to discuss the best approach to treating that specific patient. The traditional therapy would have involved surgery and chemotherapy or radiation. But after genomic sequencing, cancer patient Allison Cairns was treated only with two drugs.
In about 8 weeks from a treatment, the imaging showed about 50% reduction of a tumor. And that remains to be continued to shrink gradually after the first reduction. Over the past year now, almost a year now.
Some oncologists caution that the biology of cancer is very complicated and that there's still a lot to learn about it.
We've actually learned in some of these situations where the mutations existed in the genetic analysis and a drug was available to match that genetic mutation, in those patients it didn't work.
Others feel much more optimistic, saying they expect tumor profiling to become standard for all cancer patients. So do patients who have experienced improvement in their health.
Boy, if you can get the DNA testing and there's a match for it, I'd really highly recommend that because it works so well.
George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
In his State of the Nation address Wednesday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in told the National Assembly in Seoul that his government will not tolerate a nuclear North Korea, and the South will not possess nuclear weapons, pointing to a 1992 joint denuclearization declaration signed by both Koreas. He said his government is making efforts to manage the situation and bring about peace on the peninsula. Mr. Moon's comments came a day after a prominent North Korea defector, Tae Young Ho, said in Washington that he thinks he knows how best to deal with the growing North Korean nuclear and missile threat.
North Korea is not the subject for destruction, but it should be the subject for change. Everyone agrees with permanent peace on Korean Peninsula. So since our goal is peace, then the means to achieve that goal should be peacefully. That is the second point which I want to deliver. And thirdly, I support maximum pressure policy, but I strongly believe that maximum pressure should go together with maximum engagement. And maximum engagement, I think, should include not only the Kim Jong-un leadership, but also North Korean population as well.
Tae, the one-time deputy chief of mission at the North Korean embassy in London before he defected last year, told the Centers for Strategic and International Studies that he understands why North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants a nuclear arsenal. He said Kim felt he lacked legitimacy when he was selected by his late father in 2012, viewed economic reform as a long-term project, saw the military's conventional capability as obsolete, and feared North Korea could become a victim of a humanitarian intervention, as happened in Libya in 2011. In the meantime, Tae said, while what he called the regime's reign of terror can't be changed, reform can come from within through the dissemination of outside information. He said technological advances make it possible for North Koreans to view South Korean and U.S. programming in secret. If you're a city dweller, tapping into solar power can be challenging. Chances are you live in an apartment and can't install solar panels or get access to your roof. But VOA's Tina Trin reports community-shared solar programs are now allowing everyone to benefit from solar energy.
This is what a typical solar farm looks like. Row after row of solar panels gleaming in the sun. But in New York City, where space comes at a premium, this is what a solar farm looks like.
It's important to recognize what your assets are. So being able to look at rooftop spaces, which are often underutilized, they have a huge potential for us to be able to proactively engage and allow them to be productive spaces.
City officials are creating a community shared program on top of public housing sites that will provide solar energy to low and middle income residents.
Community solar means you don't have to worry about installing anything on your rooftop. You can buy a portion of a neighborhood shared solar farm and switch to solar that way.
Steph Spears is the co-founder of Boston-based startup Solstice, which partners with local solar farms in Massachusetts and New York State to provide community access to solar power.
The electricity from the shared farm goes back to the grid, and you as a participant see the credits show up on your utility bill every month.
Whether it comes from a farm or a city rooftop, community shared solar allows everyone to benefit and sometimes even find a new career. Miguel Rodriguez grew up in New York's public housing and now works with community service program Green City Force to educate and train low-income young adults in sustainable jobs.
Just the fact that we can bring this information to people, bring it to light, that opens the doors to many different possibilities. People will see firsthand how this will impact their community.
It's a new industry, and you know, young people who are just getting into it today are getting in on the ground floor.
It seems community shared programs may provide more than just solar power. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
You have been listening to VOA Asia Weekend, a presentation of the Voice of America in Washington, D.C. I'm Ira Melman. We invite you to hear and read more on these and many other stories and features by following Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. And remember to join us next week for VOA Asia Weekend.